Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is our new Comics Wednesday episode for January 9th, 2019. So I'm going to be talking about some of the books that are coming out today and let you know what you should be looking out for when you head to your comic shop. I'll also run down a list of some other titles that you might be interested in. So these are the books that I've had a chance to check out already, and I'm just going to give you my thoughts on why you might want to pick them up. So we're going to start with Batman number 62. It's written by Tom King with art by Mitch Gerrits, and it's part of the Nightmares story arc, which is has just started up in Batman, and it's very different, I'll say, than what we've been seeing in Batman so far. You know, we've seen Mitch Gerrits do some artwork on Batman before. He, as Mitch likes to do, he handles, you know, all the interior art, including the colors, and it really helps him set the mood. And that really works here. It's basically Batman going up against Professor Pig, and you don't realize right away that it is a dream. It's so different than what we saw in issue 61, which was very different than we saw in issue 60. And as things progress, we realize that yes, Batman is dreaming or undergoing something that doesn't quite gel. Like, you can tell something is off. So between the writing of Tom King, which can be existential and multi-layered, and with the art by Gerrits, which is very visceral, along with Clayton Cowles on letters, who does a really good job of keeping the pacing of the story at a steady pace. And a lot of the action in the story, kind of the way it unfolds, really has to do with the way that Cowles paces things through his lettering. So I know letters are kind of unsung, and they don't get enough credit in the creative process. It's similar to colorists in that nobody notices kind of when they do their job well, but if it's done poorly, you know, they get called out on it. So they don't give them enough credit for when they do things well, and they probably get too much blame when things don't go their way. So I want to call out that it works out really well. And granted, you know, Tom King is the one who is, you know, letting Cowles know, okay, this is the caption I want on this page, and this is the caption I want on this panel and such. But as far as the way the cadence, the way the words are laid out within the dialogue boxes and such, that's all Cowles. He does just a really good job. He's a very prolific letterer, and I think he's one of the best working in the business right now. So while I'm not a fan of Professor Pig, I think he's just a ridiculous character. I don't find him interesting. I don't think he's a worthy addition to the Batman mythos. He was a good choice for this story, and it's probably the best comic I've read that has Professor Pig in it, in terms of him making sense as a villain, and his characterization is spot on. Again, the art by Mitch Gerrits. The story is set kind of in a slaughterhouse, and so Gerrits' art, which can be, as I said, very visceral, sometimes a little abstract, it suits this perfectly. And the other thing, probably my favorite thing about the story, what I absolutely loved, is the inner dialogue that we get from Batman when he's talking about how he escapes from ropes and how he fights and how he's aware of, you know, what that injury has done to him and how it's going to affect his next thing. It really, more so than maybe any Batman comic I've read by Tom King up to this point, it really shows what a cerebral hero Batman is, how he's always thinking, how he knows that he is at his core just a man. He doesn't have superpowers, so he has to be acutely aware of his environment. He has to be prepared. He has to understand human anatomy and injury and, you know, medically what he's able to do and not. And that is very well demonstrated in this issue. So I thought it worked really well. I just think that King, Gerrits, and Cowles just came together to give us a really great standalone story that, you know, come to find out plays part of the larger role in the Batman Nightmares storyline. So really, really great job by the entire creative team for Batman 62. All right, next up we have Green Arrow number 48 from writers Colin Kelly and Jackson Lansing. Art is by Javier Fernandez, colors by John Kalish, and letters are by Darren Bennett. So first of all, I should say we already know Green Arrow's been canceled with issue 50. I feel like if they were going to do that, they should have let Julie and Shauna Benson tell a couple more stories, have a couple more issues. But because of things that are going on in the wider DC universe, we know that this is this book is canceled. So Colin and Jackson get a chance to script a couple of stories here, to tell a couple of Green Arrow stories over a couple of issues, three, I guess, 48, 49, and 50. But they do a great job of kind of continuing the story and the sort of the social justice fight that Green Arrow has been undertaking in the city of Seattle. But I'm just curious. I feel bad for them because I would have liked to have seen what they were going to do to continue, because they do a great job. They're paying homage. They're respecting what the Benson sisters did and tying their stories into what they did. But they clearly have their own stories to tell. And in this issue, Count Vertigo reappears. He's a classic Green Arrow villain. I like that they're bringing him back. I like that they're sort of trying to establish, you know, Green Arrow's rogues gallery is what it feels like. And they're kind of upping the ante in terms of the power level of Count Vertigo. So that feels great. It seems like they're going to keep exploring the relationship between Black Canary and Green Arrow. So that all works really well. They tie in a little bit with what's happening in Heroes in Crisis with Dinah and Ollie talking about Roy and how Green Arrow is not giving himself a chance to really grieve. So again, I just feel bad that these guys didn't get a chance to do a longer run. That being said, this is a quality issue. It's paced really well. There's a lot of action, and they're really building on the foundation that the Benson sisters left for them. So looking forward to the last couple issues, because this one was done really well. And I love the added power level that they brought to Count Vertigo. The art by Javier Fernandez is done really well. Great visuals with, if you're not familiar with Count Vertigo, he kind of messes with people's perceptions of reality. So there's a lot of mind-bending cityscapes and such, where up is down and left is right, and buildings are being twisted and turned and flipped sideways, and just really, really great artwork. I'm not sure about the colors, though. The colors, they're a little muted for my taste. I'd like them to be a little cleaner, a little more primary. But that's a minor quibble. I think that overall the story works really well. I don't know that I've ever seen Fernandez ink himself, though. So although I think the art is handled really well, it's not as clean as I'm used to seeing his art. And I just wonder if that's because he handled, his own inks. So I think he may be one of those artists where I feel like he benefits from having an inker come in and make his art even stronger. So overall, a good issue. It just feels a little anticlimactic because, the cancellation of the series has always been announced. It makes you wonder if, as much as people have been complaining about how Marvel's been stealth canceling titles in recent years, if that's not really the way that it should go, just because then you don't see a drop off. Because you almost feel like, okay, well, now that people know that this title's canceled, who's going to read these last couple of issues, right? 48's out, but who's going to read 49 and 50? And you see that on the collectible side of the market, where sometimes the last couple issues of a series, it's a really low print run. I mean, usually when a series is canceled, it's because it's not selling that well anyway. And then you announce that it's canceled, and then the orders drop off even more because people feel like, well, why should I bother reading it? Unless it's a series that's already planned to be finite. And then you keep going, you want to get to the end of the story where it has a particular ending. Well, this is Green Arrow. We know this is not the end of Oliver Queen's story. And we know there's going to be another Green Arrow title coming from DC at some point as well. But You just wonder if Marvel isn't taking the writer. I mean, for my money, no. If you're going to cancel a series, you say so. And you certainly don't keep stealth soliciting it like Robert Kirkman did with Walking Dead. But, you know, that was a little bit different as well. I mean, we know that Walking Dead wasn't canceled because of lack of sales. But yeah, I just wonder if, like, what's the right way to handle it? Because, like I said, I feel like Colin and Jackson didn't really get a chance to do what they wanted to do because they're trying to bridge the gap between what the Benson sister did and the story they're wanting to tell. And then before they can even really get started, all of a sudden they're, you know, the rug's pulled out from under them. So definitely pick up this issue, pick up the last couple of Green Arrow, because I think they're going to be worthwhile. All right, up next we have, also from DC, The Green Lantern, number 3. This is from writer Grant Morrison. Art is by Liam Sharp. Colors are by Steve Olaf, and the letters are by Tom Orzechowski. This is continuing the theme that Grant Morrison has talked about that he wants to have for The Green Lantern, which is basically like a police procedural set in space, really digging into the idea of the Green Lantern Corps as the police force of the stars. This one's called Slave Lords of the Stars, and it is Earth being auctioned off, basically. And the Door, who are an alien species who, if anybody's familiar with Kanjar Roe, the classic Justice League villain, kind of pink or flesh-colored with these eyes that look like yellow kind of gems or honeycombs, is what they look like. And like I said, they've captured a bunch of worlds, are auctioning them off to different entities, if you will. And so the Green Lantern Corps show up and they say, yeah, you can't do this. So it's interesting in terms of Morrison really leaning into that police procedural type of story like he's been wanting to tell, while he's building out the bigger undercurrent of what he wants to tell. So when you talk about the story in terms of kind of the big concepts or the kind of outline or structure of the story, it's really easy to understand. It's really simple. The problem is in the execution with Morrison. You know, I've gone on record as saying I'm not a big fan of his. I will say that I do tend to enjoy his stories once I kind of just let him, like, I'll read it once and then just put it aside and come back to it later. And then I find that when I read it later, often in bigger chunks, 3 or 4 issues at a time, it does seem to flow a little better and make a little more sense. I think that Morrison, because of the complicated nature of his plots and his stories and the way he structures things, that his stuff does read better in big chunks. But there's still that aspect of him where he puts things in stories, you know, drawing back from really obscure DC lore. And if you're like me, it can pull you out of the story. If you're able to just accept it and say, oh, I don't know about that, but it's just, you know, part of DC history, or maybe you don't even think of it as that much. You just, oh, it's just, you know, part of the story. Maybe it doesn't bother you. You can kind of gloss over it. Because sometimes he throws things in that kind of sound like old DC lore, but actually aren't. But if you're like me and you're reading something and he names a character or something that happened, it pulls me out of the story because I start thinking, wait, is that something that happened back in the DC Golden Age or DC Silver Age? Should I know what that is? Do I need the context of whatever he's referring to help inform this story? And I could, you know, fall down the Google rabbit hole of trying to find something. But again, maybe that's on me for what I'm bringing to the story. So as much as I'm not a fan of Morrison, I have been picking up the Green Lantern because of the Liam Sharp art. Liam Sharp is just a huge talent. He's so detailed, and he's doing some of the best work of his career here. You know, he came back to the DC, actually I think this might have been his first DC work when he came back and worked on Wonder Woman for Rebirth. You know, previously he'd done a lot of work with Marvel in the 90s, and I think that not enough people have been exposed to his art, and he's a little bit underappreciated. So now that he's getting a chance to draw this crazy space opera that Morrison is creating, he's really getting to flex his muscles. He's really getting to show off to some extent how much detail and crazy aliens and crazy ideas that he has. I think one of my favorite things that he's drawn so far in the series is one of the lanterns. I can't remember his name, but his head is basically a volcano, you know, very Morrison idea. But he's just drawn beautifully by Liam Sharp. So in this issue, as I mentioned, we're being privy to an interplanetary auction where these planets have been basically kidnapped, shrunken down, sold at auction, and the Earth is bought by this godlike being for reasons. I'm not going to spoil that. You can read it for yourself. But again, perfect art, beautifully rendered alien godlike being by Liam Sharp. You know, he's exactly what you would picture God to be, you know, pictures that we've seen throughout history, you know, very much the wise old man, flowing robes, the walking staff, the long white beard, the long white flowing hair, you know, kind of craggy features. Again, just rendered beautifully by Liam Sharp. So crazy ideas from Morrison, which, you know, we've come to expect. Wonderful, wonderful art by Liam Sharp, which, you know, not to take for granted, but which I've come to expect from him as well. So I think that if you're a fan of Morrison, you're going to love this. If you're a fan of detailed art, you're going to love it as well. If you are not a fan of Morrison, what I would probably suggest is maybe pick up the first trade and read the whole, you know, first five issues in one sitting and see if you can kind of get what Grant is going for, because there is a certain charm to it. There is a certain classic Silver Age feel of the Green Lantern Corps as this this police force. So after the first issue, I was unsure. After the second issue, I was like, I don't think this, I'm going to read this. It just is not doing it for me. It's too Morrison-ish. But stuck with it, read the third issue, you know, mostly because I want to see the beautiful Liam Sharp art. And I'm still, you know, buying the monthly issues because I want to support Liam's work. But sitting back and rereading issues 1 through 3 together, and I was like, you know, I can kind of see where this is going. It might not be my favorite take, and there are still some problems I have with the way Morrison tells stories, but at least I understand it a lot better. I'm getting a feel for where he's going rather than it just feeling like this fast-paced, overly complicated plot. So like I said, if you're not a fan of Morrison, but you are a fan of Liam Sharp, or you're a fan of Green Lantern, wait for the first trade to come out, pick that up, and see if you can kind of get what Morrison is going for and see if you like it. All right, up next we have an issue 1 that debuted this week. It's Young Justice number 1 from writer Brian Michael Bendis. Art is by Patrick Gleason. Colors are by Alejandro Sanchez. And DC Lettering handles the letters. I'm not going to say I'm not a fan of Young Justice. I know that it's beloved. It's a beloved property, both in terms of the cartoon and the Peter David Todd Knox series. It's just that I have no exposure to it. I've never watched the cartoon. I've never read any of the Young Justice series. So I can't really say whether or not this compares favorably to Young Justice from before or not. What I will say is that there's a lot going on here and it's not explained very well. And I think for a first issue, it needs to be a little more new reader friendly. Things need to be a little more spelled out. Where Bendis does a great job is in the characterization of the characters that show up in the first issue. He's got a great voice for Cassie Sandsmark, for Tim Drake. We even see, spoilers a little bit here, but he is on the cover. We even see Connor Kent show up here. So he's back. Where's he been? There's also a cover that has Bart Allen, Impulse. So he's back as well. Ginny Hicks, who's a character that Bendis introduced in, I think it was his Batman Universe title, the Walmart books. She shows up. She's got a great voice, kind of a new character, a fresh character. And we're also introduced to another new character named Teen Lantern, who don't know a lot about her yet, but apparently she figured out how to hack a Green Lantern ring and now has Green Lantern powers. That doesn't sound like a thing to me. Green Lantern rings are one of the most complicated, most powerful, you know, artifacts and weapons in the universe, and you're having some kid to hack into it and be able to wield it. Yeah, that doesn't work for me on that level. So, but as far as getting the voices down, the characters sound true to who they are, what I know of them anyway. So I did like that. I did like the interaction between the characters. But as far as what's going on, yeah, absolutely no clue. Absolutely no clue what's going on in this issue. In terms of we see some Gemworld, we see some Metropolis, and then we see a portal open, and we see all those characters I mentioned all gathered together, characters that I will call Young Justice because that's what Bart Allen refers to them as. We all see them kind of show up in the same place at the end, but where that place is, we don't know. I'm assuming Gemworld, but I don't really know. So again, I just think not super new reader friendly. It seems to be a trend that a lot of creators have gone to, sort of starting the story just right in the middle of the action and then going back and filling in, which is okay to do it that way sometimes, but it feels like it's getting to be a little too often. It's getting to be a trope these days. Can I just get a story that starts at the beginning, please? A comic that is easy to understand. And I know that number one issues are probably the hardest issues to write in terms of you've got to introduce new readers to the concepts and the characters and, you know, give them an idea of what the story is going to be out, but still, you know, have a satisfying issue that tells a good chunk of the story. So really, really tough to do. You know, when you're working with super well-established characters that people are familiar with, like Justice League, let's say, probably one of the best number one issues I've read in a while was Scott Snyder's Justice League number one. He didn't really have to spend any time introducing people to who those characters were because they're the legends, you know, the icons known around the world. This is not the case with characters like, you know, Teen Lantern and Ginny Hex. So Bendis does have that extra obstacle of needing to introduce those characters and tell us who they are. But again, he's Brian Michael Bendis. You know, he's supposed to be one of the best in the business. So if you earn that reputation, you got to continue to live up to it. So all that to say, I wasn't disappointed in the first issue because I didn't have any expectations going in, being that I'm not the biggest Brian Michael Bendis fan. And what he has been doing on Superman, you all know I haven't liked. So I didn't have any expectations, and I didn't bring in any sort of, you know, idea of who these characters are when they're together as Young Justice. So I'll keep reading, and hopefully things will start to make sense relatively quickly. Of the characters of Young Justice, there's nobody that really stands out. I do like Tim Drake as Robin. I go back and forth between him and Dick Grayson as my favorite Robin. I can't really decide who I like more. Maybe, you know, sometimes it's Dick, sometimes it's Tim, but it depends on, you know, which day of the week or probably whose stories I've read more recently. So I do like him. Ginny Hex, again, new character, but I do like the way that Bendis is writing her in terms of the voice he's giving her. She seems like a no-nonsense kind of person that lives up to the Hex name. I love Cassie Sandsmark. I think she's a great character. I think she's been underutilized in the DCU for quite a while. So I do look forward to finding out more about her. Connor Kent, you know, Superboy, I can kind of take him or leave him. I'm not that big a fan. And I know he's beloved, but my only exposure to him, you know, I didn't read the Geoff Johns Teen Titans run, where I think is kind of where he sort of became a lot of people's favorite. Where I know him from is the return of the Superman, you know, after the death of Superman. And there he was kind of cocky and annoying. And so that kind of still has stuck with me. I haven't read any stories of a more mature Connor Kent. So maybe, you know, if I if I continue to read Young Justice and learn more about Connell, then maybe I'll come around to other people's way of thinking. Yeah, Bart Allen, Teen Lantern, I could take Bart or leave him. He can be annoying at times as well. Teen Lantern, you know, like I said, I don't know enough about her, and her premise just seems really far-fetched to me. So, but I'm going to keep reading Young Justice just to see how it goes in terms of what Bendis does with Cassie. And I'm interested to learn more about Jenny Hex as well. So we'll see where it goes. The art is by Patrick Gleason. He is a superstar artist. He can draw in so many different styles. He does a good job here of keeping the art pretty clean. And it feels very fresh and vibrant and young. And so it very much suits the characters that he's rendering here. So no complaints about the art at all. All right, up next, I'm going to talk about Blackbird number 4. This is from creators Jen Bartel and Sam Humphries, who created the character and the concept. Layout artist is Paul Renwand. We have colors by Triona Farrell and letters by Jody Wynn. I think I often talk about the colors of this book before I talk about anything else in terms of what's going on with the artwork. That's because the art by Triona, the color art by Triona Farrell is absolutely outstanding. It's impactful. It tends to be a little primary, but it suits the book and the tone and the story so, so well. Just vibrant colors. You know, there's a lot of magic in this book, so you know, the lightning and the magical powers and the colors that people exhibit when they're using these powers are all done really, really well. She handles the sort of the downbeat, the slower parts of the story very well also, because our main protagonist, Nina, she's definitely struggling with, you know, things like depression and loneliness and such. And so as bright as things are in the sort of the world behind the world, the magical world that exists in this comic, when it's Nina in the real world dealing with her emotions, things are sufficiently subdued, and it works. The color work here is just exquisite. It works so well. Some of the best color work that I've seen in a really long time. And those colors are laid over Jen Bartel's pencils, who for me, there's nobody in comics that draws fashion better than Jen Bartel. It's really great. I'm not a fashion person at all, as my daughter can tell you. She's got a better fashion sense, had a better fashion sense at like 3 or 4 years old than I do, and it's only gotten better as she's gotten older. So I don't know fashion at all. I have a tough time knowing what looks good and what doesn't. But here, it's clear that Jen loves fashion, and whether it's dressing Nina in some contemporary clothes for her to lounge around the house, or the way she looks when she goes out, it's always kind of realistic and interesting in terms of, you know, accessories. She's always got earrings or, you know, a necklace or a belt or things in her hair. So it's very much, you know, realistic in terms of the way that people that care about fashion dress, right? Like even when we're talking about the jacket that a police detective might wear, it's just really interesting to look at, like interesting cuts, interesting, you know, the way things dress. And again, I'm not a fan of fashion, but I find it interesting and compelling to look at these different clothes that she's dressing people in. It's clear that she loves fashion. She's done her research and she's showing off her skills to some extent. And then when you talk about the way some of these paragons, these magic wielders dress, and she gets to be even more flamboyant with as they're wearing capes and tunics and different kind of things. So the art is really spectacular. Facial expressions are done well. The storytelling from panel to panel flows well. The facial expressions, especially the motion with Nina, done well. Can't find fault with the art. Just it's absolutely gorgeous. And my favorite part, even though I'm not a fashion person at all, is just looking at the different outfits and the way that she not only dresses people but accessorizes them as well. So done really, really well. The dialogue from Sam Humphries is also handled well. I know that Sam is very interested in people that have to deal with problems like depression and anxiety and things like that, things that he's had to deal with and has personal experience with himself. So I feel like he is giving good, accurate, true emotions to the characters in this story. In this particular issue, we saw at the end of issue 3 that something that Nina thought to be true, something that has basically colored her whole middle teen years through her adulthood, turns out not to be true. And I'm trying to speak vaguely about that because I don't want to spoil it for you. But when we see what is actually the truth, and when Nina discovers it, it's obviously a very emotional for her, and it makes a lot of sense. And that's all handled well and realistically with within the story. So if you're not familiar with Blackbird, it's basically the story of this girl, Nina, who and her sister, who lost their mother at a young age. They're estranged from their father, and they're trying to make it on their own. But Nina has always had this belief that magic really does exist in kind of a world behind a world. And in issue 1, she finds that to be true. And so far, the story's been about her journey to sort of discover the truth about that world behind the world, and what it has to do with her family, what it has to do with her mother, who she believes, you know, died when Nina was around 16. And we see her sister, Nina's sister, get kidnapped as well. And what does that mean? And can Nina rescue her sister? And so it's magic, it's family, it's emotion, it's a beautiful color work, it's wonderful art, it's wonderful, interesting fashion, and a really, really great book. You know, I'm not going to pigeonhole and say that this book is only for, you know, a female audience, because I'm really enjoying it. But I will say, just based on the color work, based on the strong female characters, based on, you know, the really cool fashion, if you do know a female who's interested in getting into comics, in learning about comics and starting to read comics, I think this would be a great first series to give somebody who wants to see what comics is all about, because it is a compelling story with just absolutely stunning artwork. So we get a sneak peek of the next issue, issue 5, and that's another stunning cover. Just really gorgeous book. So gets a good high recommendation from me. Next up, we have another Image book. It's Die, issue 2, from Kieran Gillen and artist Stephanie Hans. We've got the great Clayton Cowles, who I talked about earlier on Letters, and the design is by Ryan Hughes. You know, I mentioned earlier about Justice League number 1 by Scott Snyder being one of the best number 1s I've read in quite a while. I might put Die number 1 right up there with it, because that was an issue where as soon as I finished reading it, I was blown away, jumped on social media, talked about how great it was, you know, started reaching out to friends saying, hey, if you haven't picked this up, you need to, you know, read Die number 1. It's really, really cool. It's a role-playing game-based story in terms of, you know, Kieran Gillen kind of hearkening back to his childhood, playing Dungeons and Dragons and other kind of role-playing games. He's created a game, he's created a world, and he's got a story that he's telling about people that play that game and then are sucked into that world. So what's really interesting is that if you're a person that plays D&D or role-playing games, you can relate to this book from that level. But even if you don't, because I'm not a gamer, I've never played D&D, I'm not an RPG guy at all, but yet I'm still fully sucked in, still fully immersed, still absolutely blown away by the first issue, the different roles that these characters are playing. And we saw in the first issue basically what happens is one of the group of that belongs to this group of gamers creates this game called Die for another one of the group's birthdays, and they all play it, and they're all given a die. Like one of them gets a, you know, 4-sided die, one of them gets a 6-sided, one of them gets an 8, 10, 12, 20, and so on and so forth. And they each are the only one that gets to roll that die. Well, apparently those die were magical in some way. Those dice were magical in some way, and they are sucked into the world, and they disappear for several years, and then they all come back save one. And that's basically what happens in issue one. We're introduced to them. We see that the ones that have returned are sort of haunted by the experience of whatever happened in that magical realm. We're not privy to it at all. But the characterization, the realism, the trauma, the artwork by Stephanie Hans depicting all of this, all of it is handled expertly well. There's also a good bit of back matter, essays in the back of these first two issues by Kieran Gillen that sort of explain where he's coming from, how he created the characters, how he created the world, why he made the choices he did, which add even more to the story. When you read those essays and then go back and reread the book, you pull even more out of it, even more out of the characterizations, where the characters are coming from, why they say the things they say. So it makes for a very rich reading experience. So yes, Justice League number one, really good first issue. One of the best in the last couple of years, but I'm going to have to put Die up there right along with it. And the series is absolutely exceptional. Stephanie Hans is the perfect artist to draw this. She uses a little bit of a watercolor type style, which allows for the action to be visceral, especially when you're talking about, you know, a fantasy world where there's walking zombies with maggots for eyes, and there's blood, and there's actions and sword fights and grief knights and monsters and demons and smoke and mist. I mean, she just handles all of it so well. It's a gorgeous book to look at. And if you have somebody who's a gamer, if you have somebody who plays D&D, I think you absolutely have to introduce them to this book. They're absolutely going to love it. So it's tone perfect. It's interesting. It's RPG fantasy slash horror, and a really rich world. I can't wait to see what happens next. One of the best titles on stands right now. I don't want to say too much more about it because I don't want to spoil it. I think I've given you all you need to know. But definitely, if you do pick this book up, definitely read the back matter, read the essays by Kieran Gillen that explain his creative process. And I think, like I said, you'll get even more out of the story that he, Stephanie, and Clayton are telling. All right, last book I'm going to talk about is Rose, number 16, written by Meredith Finch. We have art by Ig Guara, colors by Triona Farrell. Her name's popping up again in this episode. And we have letters by Cardinal Ray. So this is the penultimate issue of this series, which talks about a land where magic and the ability to wield magic became a death sentence. And we saw that there were magic wielders that became bound to these felines, these giant cats, if you will. They spell cat, K-H-A-T. And we meet Rose. We find out she's basically the kind of the last of these magic wielders, and her mother hid that ability from her. And when she discovered it, she had to go on the run. And so as things are coming to a head here with the rebellion against the evil queen Drusilla's power, we see that the remaining cat, the one that it has been supposed to have been destined to be bound to Rose, the cat's name is Thorn, so, you know, Rose and Thorn, Drusilla managed to find a way through magical means to basically take him from Rose to bind Thorn to her rather than to Rose. So this issue is what happens next. What is Thorn going to be able to break free? Is Rose going to be able to prevent her own demise at Thorn's hands, basically? And the fallen knight, if you will, that started out as Drusilla's right-hand man, we saw, you know, when he initially captured Rose, Rose was able to win him over. And he is basically Rose's champion at this point. So what happens there? Can he help Rose to defeat Drusilla? What happens with Drusilla's brother? Like, there's all these different plot threads that Meredith Finch has had sort of different plates spinning in the air with the freedom fighters and such. And so everything here is set up for the finale, set up for the final issue in 17. And that's not to say that this feels like a down issue in terms of action or pacing. Sometimes that'll happen. I've talked before about how every issue can't be pedal to the metal, absolutely maxed out, because if you don't have anything to compare it to, if you don't have issues that are a little bit slower with, you know, less going on, slower paced, then you have nothing to contrast it against. So that being said, this one's full of action. We get Ser Dante fighting against Drusilla and Thorne trying to protect Rose. We get a little bit of the rebellion and what they're doing to be prepared for this final confrontation with Drusilla. And we get a little bit of Drusilla's brother and him kind of finally coming to terms with what Drusilla has done and being willing to risk his life for his kingdom, the kingdom that he is prince of and rightful ruler of. So it's actually a very, very fast-paced issue. And I think part of that is because Meredith Finch is telling such a big story in only 17 issues. She's created a very rich world with a lot of different moving parts and interesting characters and interesting concepts. And this is really a story that could have taken place over like 50 issues. Like that's how rich the world is that she's created. And so her cramming it in to 17 issues is, I think she's handling it very well. It doesn't feel rushed and it doesn't feel choppy. It does feel like the world could support more, you know, could have supported, you know, more issues in a slower pace, but maybe the sales and, you know, that ultimately that's what it all comes down to on these creator owned books. And so, I love this issue. I love the series. I basically picked it up on the strength of Meredith Finch's writing, who, you know, she's David Finch's wife, who, you know, a lot of people will know David Finch. He's a superstar artist, done a lot of great things, a lot of work on Batman that's beloved. And David and Meredith worked together on Wonder Woman. That was some of my favorite Wonder Woman comics that I've ever read. And I got a chance to interview Meredith about that. And so, you know, when I saw she was writing another story with a female protagonist, I'm like, oh, I definitely have to check that out. You know, here's her own concept, her own idea, her own world that she's created. She's not, you know, doesn't have to answer to any editorial dictates or anything like that in terms of, oh, maybe she wanted to tell this story with Wonder Woman but couldn't because of other things going on in the DCU. And rightly so, DC wants to protect their intellectual property and all that kind of thing. Well, here is Meredith getting to cut loose. And so I decided, well, I got to see what that's going to be like. And I haven't been disappointed. It's been really spectacular. Absolutely love the world that she's created. And I think I talk about this once in a while, how if you want to get your kids into reading, you want to get them, you know, reading comics or just reading in general, there's a few different series over the years that I've recommended as great bedtime stories. Skyward by Jeremy Dale, the late great Jeremy Dale, comes to mind. This is another one. This is another one that's great. There's not, you know, violence or blood, like something like Die that I just talked about from Karen Gillan. That's not something that you could share with your 10 or 12 year old. At least most 10 or 12 year olds are just not mature enough to handle it. Very mature themes. The story in the world that Meredith is crafting, it's very much a little more innocent, a little more black and white in terms of good guy, bad guy. I think a lot of the concepts that she's created here are easily grasped by, you know, younger readers. And I just feel like she's done a great job of creating a fantasy world that a young adult reader could very much enjoy, and it could get them interested in reading. So I do recommend it for that reason as well. So, and I'll certainly be talking about the final issue here in a couple weeks when it comes out. But again, really, really great stuff from Meredith Finch. The art by Ig Guerra, like a lot of the books that I've talked about today, the art is perfectly suited. I know that Meredith took a couple breaks while Rose was coming out, and that was basically because Ig needed a break. He's drawn every issue of the series, and, you know, rightfully so. Meredith was like, I don't want to do this book with anybody but Ig, and he does a great job. It's interesting, his style. Sometimes he uses very clean lines, and other times it's a lot less clean, but it always suits that part of the story really, really well. And so I love the character designs he's come up with. You know, he doesn't have like a traditional comic book style. It's a little more stylized. And for some stories, it doesn't necessarily work for me, that cleaner style. But when you're talking about fantasy, you're talking about magic, You're talking about interesting characters and clothing and all that kind of thing. His art is absolutely perfect for this. Wonderful facial expressions, wonderful panel layouts, a lot of emotion in his art. So he does a really, really good job. And then, you know, speaking about Triona Farrell, I was just talking about her work on Blackbird and how primary and beautiful it was. And then here we are, same color artist, and you flip over to Rose and everything is pastel and everything is a little bit muted. And even the blues that indicate magic, or the yellows that indicate magic, are, you know, they're not that primary tone. They're much softer and more earthy. So it's just amazing how you can take the same color artist and they flip the palette around to suit the book. And that shows the skill and the talent and what a wonderful color artist Triona Farrell is. So there's a few panels she does in this book where she goes monochromatic or dichromatic, you know, just one or two colors for impact. I love when colorists do that. And Triona uses it sparingly throughout Rose, but it works really, really well. So the color work in this series and in this this issue in particular is handled wonderfully. It's great, especially the last couple pages where she gives everything kind of this reddish overtone to kind of show us that we're reaching the climax of the story that Meredith Finch has been crafting. So absolutely wonderful job by Triona Farrell and Iguara on the art, and a wonderfully crafted story by Meredith Finch. I'm gonna miss Rose when it's done. I hope that Meredith comes back to that world at some point. All right, a few other books coming out on January 9th that you might be interested in. From Aftershock Comics, we've got Moth and Whisper number 5 and Patience, Conviction, Revenge, wrapping up those couple of series. Over at DC, in addition to the books I talked about, we've got Injustice, Gods Among Us, Year 4, the complete collection trade paperback. And we also have Martian Manhunter number 2 from... I'm drawn by Steve Orlando and Riley Rossmo, which is a really, really great book. That's one I wasn't sure how I was going to feel about it based on the first issue, but it's a very emotional look so far at who Martian Manhunter is. So I'm very curious to see where that series goes. We've got Turok number 1 from Dynamite. Over at IDW, Euthanauts number 5, which has been a really great series from Tinney Howard. From Image, Bitterroot number 3, which has been a critically acclaimed success so far. From Sanford Green and David S. Walker. We've also got Curse Words number 19 from Charles Soule and Ryan Brown as that series heads toward its conclusion. Over at Marvel, there's a new Captain Marvel number 1 written by Kelly Thompson. We've got Friendly Spider-Man number 1 written by Tom Taylor, who is a writer whose star is on the rise in a lot of ways. There's also a new number 1 Star Wars title coming out for Marvel today. It's Star Wars Age of Republic Jango Fett number 1. So talking about Boba Fett's father. And then last book I'll mention from Marvel is Uncanny X-Men number 9, which is the penultimate issue of the X-Men Disassembled storyline. So those are some more titles that you may want to be on the lookout for when you hit your comic book shop today. And as always, I want to thank everybody for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.